The Dublin Walking Tour 2023. This tour begins up at the top of O'Connell Street. So my suggestion is hop on the Red Lewis Line anywhere in Dublin and ride north across the Liffey and up O'Connell Street. Get off at the top of O'Connell Street Upper. Then go ahead and cross the street and head uphill toward the tall, slender spire of the Abbey Presbyterian Church. That's about 400 meters up the street. Walk up the left-hand side of the road beyond the Gate Theater, and you'll find the Garden of Remembrance on your left. Enter the garden and feel free to walk around while I tell you about this place. The Garden of Remembrance was once a pleasure garden connected to the nearby Rotunda Hospital. In 1966, 50 years after the Easter Rising, President Eamon de Valera officially opened this memorial garden to commemorate the lives of all those who died during Ireland's struggle to gain independence. It was designed to be a place of quiet remembrance and reflection. Additionally, it is constructed on the spot where some of the Easter Rising leaders were held before being carted off to Kilmainham Jail and their execution. Have a look at the reflecting pool. The pool is in the shape of a cross to recognize Ireland's Christian heritage. There is even more symbolism here. Notice the wavy mosaic tiles emulating the island's many rivers. At the bottom, find ancient weapons, a sword, a spear, and a shield, designed to represent the old Celtic tradition of breaking weapons and throwing them into the water as an offering to the gods to end hostilities. The bronze statue at the end of the pool describes a pagan legend of four siblings in the agonizing process of changing from mere mortals to swans. The sculptor, Ossin Kelly, used this well-known fable to couple visually with W.B. Yeats' poem, Easter 1916, with the famous line, "All is changed, changed utterly. A terrible beauty is born," prompting us to reflect on the atrocities of war and the birth of the Irish nation. Nearby is a bronze plaque with the words of another poem titled We Saw a Vision, penned by Liam MacGustin in 1977. In the darkness of despair, we saw a vision. We lit the light of hope, and it was not extinguished. Later on in the poem, closing out, it says, "The vision became a reality. Winter became summer. Bondage became freedom. And this we left to you as your inheritance. O generations of freedom, remember us, the generations of the vision." Another notable event happened in May 2011, when Queen Elizabeth II visited the Garden of Remembrance. She laid a wreath and bowed her head at the foot of the statue. One can only imagine her thoughts at that moment, perhaps thinking of the rebel boys who were executed and their impact on the United Kingdom and the Irish. In retrospect, it was a unifying moment that, over time, healed many of the pent-up pains and wounds of the Irish. Now finally, let's look up at the Irish flag. This tricolored flag became a unifying and official symbol of the Republic in 1937. Green for the Irish, orange for the Protestants, and white for the hope of a lasting peace between the two. exit the Garden of Remembrance through the gate to the right of the Children of Lyra statue. You may need to climb the stairs and exit onto Parnell Square North. Across the street is the Irish Writers' Center. This small museum, with only 3 rooms, features the history and works of some of Dublin's noted writers. If you are into writing and poetry, it's worth a quick look. Admission is about €8. Out the gate, turn left and walk to the corner, turn right again and head downhill. Exit the Garden of Remembrance through the gate to the right of the Children of Lyra statue. You may need to climb a little bit up the stairs and exit on Parnell Square North. Out the gate, turn left, walk to the corner, and turn again, then head downhill. About halfway down the block, on the left is the Rotunda Hospital. This hospital was built here in 1745 and now is Dublin's premier maternity hospital. Walk to the end of the block, then you want to cross the street and turn left. Walk a couple of blocks back to O'Connell Street Upper, where you exited the Lewis tram a little earlier. Turn right on to O'Connell Street and look back at the obelisk in the middle of the intersection. The obelisk at the top of O'Connell Street, soaring almost 60 feet in the air, is a tribute to Charles Stuart Parnell. Mr. Parnell was an Irish-born Member of Parliament in the 1880s. Known as a powerful landowner and an avid supporter of Irish Home Rule, and he was a promoter of independence from Britain. He was well-liked, a charismatic orator, and an excellent politician. Parnell came very close to negotiating a peaceful Irish independence, but it was cut short by scandal. Parnell was outed carrying on illicitly with a mistress. Shortly after, he was run out of politics, and his quest for Irish independence died. Now turn around and walk downhill toward the west on O'Connell Street. If you can, try to get in the center median. That way you can see both sides of the street as we progress downhill. On the left, notice the famous Gresham Hotel. It has recently been renovated and now is a part of the Rhea Plaza hotel chain. Since 1817, the Gresham has been known as one of Dublin's finest. Step inside for an expensive coffee, a tea, or a drink. Also, next to the Gresham is the old Savoy Cinema, where in the 1920s, Dubliners attended special events and movie openings. Now, it's a multi-cinemaplex offering 6 theaters. However, a bit of the old remains and tours of the historic theater are available. The Lewis, Dublin's public transportation tram system, premiered in 2004, linking the suburbs with the city center. Here on O'Connell Street, you'll find it running down the middle of the street in the median. Lewis is the Irish word for speed, and it is really fast and an economical way to get around the city. Down the street, looking west, is the Millennium Spire. This piece of art soars 390 feet up to the heavens. It's made of stainless steel and cost about 5 million euro to plan and erect. Construction began in the 1990s, and the goal was to have its premiere at the turn of the millennium. Unfortunately, that did not happen due to construction delays and budget overruns. It was finally completed and erected in 2004, gaining some creative nicknames such as the erection at the intersection, the stiffy on the liffy, the stiletto in the ghetto, and the poker near the croaker. The spire replaced an older monument dating back from the days of the British oppression. Nelson's Pillar was a 130 feet tall monument dedicated to Lord Horatio Nelson and his historic win at the Battle of Trafalgar in 1805. The pillar went up here on what was then known as Saxville Street in 1809. The pillar was dynamited to smithereens on Easter 1966, the 50th year anniversary of the Easter Rising. No one was ever arrested for the deed, but the IRA is suspected to be the culprit. O'Connell Street has changed drastically since my first march down the center. In 2005, I was a high school band teacher. We loaded up our marching band, flew across the Atlantic, and marched down O'Connell Street in Dublin's St. Patrick's Day Parade. 500,000 people lined the street, sometime 8 to 10 deep, between here and St. Patrick's Cathedral. O'Connell Street was three lanes at about 20 yards wide back then. Now it's as wide as a football field and 500 meters long. Notice the street is lined with department stores, tourist shops, and plenty of fast food joints. O'Connell Street has long been the main drag here in Dublin. In fact, it was second only to London in the British Empire when it came to riches, culture, music, and banking. It was once lined with marble Georgian buildings, home of the rich and famous, the who's who of the empire. O'Connell Street suffered a lot of damage in the War of Independence and the Civil War, and what you see here is mostly dilapidated brick rebuild dating from the mid-20th century. The one remaining structure from Dublin's golden era is the GPO, the General Post Office. This huge neoclassical building with iconic columns out the front was designed by a Brit, Francis Johnson, in 1877. It is much more to the Irish than just a post office. The GPO is a national symbol for the Irish because it was the site of the 1916 Easter Rising. Outside, notice the pillars are still pockmarked with English bullet holes. Have a look inside the historic old building. Much of it has been rebuilt after the 1916 fire, but the facade is the original. Today, it still is a working post office, although much larger than any I've ever visited. If you have time, try to visit the GPO Witness History Museum inside the GPO. It tells the fascinating story of the Easter Rising. On April 24th, 1916, Easter Monday, a group of revolutionaries stormed the GPO. These young men were a part of some 12,000 active participants who had already taken over the strategic locations across Dublin, including Stephen's Green, where we'll end this tour. The GPO was a strategic location for Britain, with its postal service, telegraph, and communications reaching to the remainder of the empire. The revolutionaries barricaded themselves inside, took down the Union Jack, and raised the Irish green, white, and orange tricolor. Then they declared Ireland a free nation. Then Patrick Pearse stepped outside and read the Proclamation of the Irish Republic. Pearse and six others declared themselves representatives of the Provisional Government of the Irish Republic and signed the proclamation. Battle went on for 6 days in the streets of Dublin. The 1,200 Irish revolutionaries were outnumbered by some 19,000 British troops. They didn't have a chance of success. The British set the GPO on fire, but the fire helped the rebels escape to nearby Moore Street. Pearse realized it was a lost cause, and he issued the surrender of the military council of the newly proclaimed Irish Republic. He did this to prevent the further slaughter of civilian population, and in hopes of saving our followers, now hopelessly surrounded and outnumbered. Initially, most Irish people were appalled by the death and destruction unleashed by the rebellion, and the defeat of the rebels were just jeered by onlookers as they were led through the streets of Dublin. In all, over 450 people were killed and 2,600 were wounded during the rising. Over half the people who died were civilians who had been caught in the fighting that occurred in the densely populated slums on Dublin's north side. All of those arrested were taken to Richmond's barrack for processing. The court-martials were held in the gymnasium building, and the 16 leaders of the rebellion were sentenced to death, including the 7 signatories of the proclamation. They were executed by firing squad at Kilmainham Jail, and their bodies were quickly and secretly carried across the Liffey and buried in a mass grave at Arbor Hill. On the first day, Patrick Pearse, Thomas McDonough, Tom Clark. On the second day, Edward Daly, Michael O'Hanrahan, Will Pearse, and Joseph Mary Plunkett. Then, after a pause, John McBride, Eamon Sinnott, Michael Mallon, Sean Houston, Con Colbert, and James Connolly, and Sean McDermida were all shot to death at Kilmainham Jail. The British cruel response, unfounded arrests, and needless execution soon turned the tide of the Irish public opinion. It wasn't long before the rebels were looked on as martyrs, not young and foolish troublemakers. Their deaths united the nation with a steady eye toward independence. Turn around and walk back toward the spire. Henry Street is on the east side of the GPO. Turn down this pedestrian street and head north along the wall of the GPO. I like to call Henry Street the local street. This is where the Irish go to shop for clothes, have a coffee, visit outdoor markets, take a stroll, and meet up with friends. A few blocks down, you'll find Moore Street on the right. Moore Street is loaded with outdoor markets each weekday morning. It's the home to F.X. Buckley, a famous meat shop known even today for its all-Irish beef, pork, chicken, and lamb. Henry Street was developed by Henry Moore, Earl of Drogheda. He named a lot of the streets in this area after himself, such as Henry Street, Moore Street, and Earl Street. Continue walking and taking in the crowds. The character and the vibe of the street changes with the time of day. Morning brings families and shoppers. Midday, you'll find the fast food and coffee shops filling up fast. By night, it's a place for all locals to rendezvous for dinner or a pub session. Arnaud's, on the left, is Ireland's oldest department store, founded in 1843. It sells everything from pharmacies to shoes, clothing, and sporting goods. Penny's department store on Mary Street began right here in 1969. It too is Irish owned and sells affordable clothing. Turn left on Liffey Street Upper. It runs west between Arnaud's and the British department store Mark and Spencer. Continue straight, cross the Red Lewis tram tracks, and jog on to Liffey Street Lower. In one block, you'll come to the River Liffey. Cross the street. The Haypenny Bridge. This iconic footbridge across the River Liffey opened to the public in 1816. It was originally named the Wellington Bridge after the Dublin-born Duke of Wellington. Before the bridge's construction, there were 7 ferries operating on the river. William Walsh, the ferry operator, let the ferries fall into disrepair and was ordered to either fix the ferries or build a bridge. He chose to build a footbridge and was granted the right to collect a halfpenny toll from anyone crossing the bridge for 100 years. Turnstiles occupied each end of the bridge and accepted a halfpenny to open. Originally, the toll was based on the cost of riding the ferry across the river. Another condition placed on Mr. Walsh was that if the citizens of Dublin found that the bridge was objectionable within the first year, it would have to be removed at no cost to the city. Obviously, it stood the test of time. Toll was discontinued here in 1919, and in recent years, its name has been officially changed to the Liffey Bridge, but Halfpenny seems to have stuck. Don't cross the bridge. We'll visit the other side shortly. Turn left and walk down the river on the dock-like walkway. Head over to the middle of the bridge in the pedestrian median. The wide O'Connell Street Bridge. Standing at the center of O'Connell Bridge, take a look around. This city covers a lot of territory and a lot of history. Look down the river to the south toward the new construction and multitude of cranes hanging in the air. The mouth of the River Liffey is that way, as well as a huge natural harbor. Liberty Hall is the fourth tallest building in Ireland and is historically significant as the headquarters of the Irish Transportation and General Workers Union and the Irish Citizens Army, the ICA. It was erected in 1965, and until the 21st century, it was Ireland's tallest building. Farther down the river, the large 18th-century neoclassical building with the green patina copper dome is the Customs House, built by the English in the 18th-century Georgian style. These next few sites may be beyond your sight of vision here from O'Connell Bridge, but if you have the time later, they all deserve a look. Beyond the third bridge down the river is the Famine Memorial. In 1845, a fungal disease, or a potato blight, struck all of the potatoes in Ireland and wiped out a third of the potato crop that year. This was a disaster to the peasants who relied upon it. Those who lived near the town were better off since the towns had other sources of food, but things got very bad for those living in rural areas. By 1846, the existing potato supplies had been sold out, and many began to slowly starve. The British government made some effort by importing corn from the United States to feed the starving, and this helped prevent mass death for the first year of the famine. Then, in 1846, the potato crop failed again, and this time wiped out almost all of the potatoes in Ireland. Thousands of people starved to death, particularly in the countryside. Additionally, many died of related diseases such as scurvy, typhus, and dysentery. Again, the British set up soup kitchens for the poor, but they drastically underestimated the scale of the disaster, and many people did not receive any aid at all. Rich British landlords evicted many peasants who could not pay their rent because they had no potatoes to sell. Even today, many cannot understand why Britain, apparently the richest nation on earth at the time, and with an empire stretching around the globe, could do nothing to help the starving Irish. Many believe that a combination of Irish overpopulation, racism, religious fanaticism, and poor economic policies all combined to allow the English to take a blind eye to that which was going on in Ireland at the time. A bit farther down the river is a replica ship, the Jenny Johnson, a three-masted ship that was originally built in Canada in 1847. The original Jenny Johnson was bought by the Tralee Company, a Kerry-based merchant named John Donovan and Sons. It was a cargo vessel and traded successfully between Tralee and North America for about 10 years. The trading paradigm was to bring immigrants from Ireland to North America and then to bring timber back to Europe. The famine made a big impression upon this ship and many like her. She made her maiden voyage from Blennerville, County Kerry to Quebec on the 24th of April, 1848 with 193 immigrants on board. As the effects of the famine ravaged on in Ireland, between 1848 and 1855, the Jenny Johnson made 16 voyages to North America, selling to Quebec, Baltimore, and New York. On average, the length of the transatlantic journey was about 47 days. The most passengers she ever carried was 254, from Tralee to Quebec on the 17th of April, 1852. Hey, to kind of put this number in perspective, the replica ship is only licensed to carry 40 people, including the crew. In all its years, the Jenny Johnson never lost a soul. In 1858, en route to Quebec, with a cargo load of timber, she became waterlogged. The crew climbed into the riggings, and after 9 days clinging to their slowly sinking ship, they were rescued by a Dutch ship, the Sophia Elizabeth. Even in her loss and her sinking, she maintained her perfectly safety record of no deaths recorded. The Epic is a museum about Irish immigration and is well worth an hour of your time if you have it available. Farther downriver is the Samuel Beckett Bridge. The architect is Santiago Calatrava, a designer of a number of innovative bridges and buildings around the Dublin area. This is the second bridge in the area designed by Calatrava, the first being the James Joyce Bridge, which is further upstream. The shape of the span and its cables is said to evoke an image of the Irish harp laying on its side, which is a prolific image and icon of Ireland. Beyond is the Docklands and the Dublin Harbor. This area lay derelict after the recession in 2008. Unfinished, dingy gray concrete towers, facades, and decaying wood forms littered the entire area up here. In recent years, the Docklands have seen a resurgence in construction and gentrification abounds. Now, turn around and look up river. To the north, lining the river are the quays that serve a grand promenade. To the left is the Sheikh Temple Bar area, and to the right are the Henry Street shops. Farther up river, on the right bank, you may see the green dome of Four Courts. The Four Courts is the principal seat of the Supreme Court, the Court of Appeals, the High Court, and Dublin Circuit Court. Another building in the Georgian neoclassical style, it was built here between 1786 to 1796. And beyond, on the left bank, you may see a conical stone tower with a green dome. This is located on the Guinness Brewery property and is a remnant of an old windmill. Beyond, still on the Guinness property, is the Guinness Storehouse and the Gravity Bar. This is the number one tourist attraction in all of Ireland. Here you can pay up to €25 to go in, see a bit about the production of Guinness, and have a pint with great views across County Dublin all the way back to the Wicklow Mountains and out to the Irish Sea. Now, turn your attention and look up O'Connell Street toward the spire. Just in front of you is the Daniel O'Connell Monument. Daniel O'Connell was born in County Kerry on August 6, 1775. Eventually, he became a politician, mayor of Dublin, and member of Parliament. He earned the nickname the Liberator due to his work to secure freedom for the Catholics. O'Connell was able to attend college in France due to his wealthy parents' fortunes. He acquired a good education, but because he was Catholic, he was not allowed to hold a political office or even an important job in Ireland. Britain's laws forbid anyone other than Protestants to hold important positions. O'Connell formed the Catholic Association in 1823. It was an organization whose goal was to work for Catholic emancipation. At Catholic Association meetings and mega rallies, O'Connell spoke charismatically, attracting large crowds of supporters. Then, in 1828, an election was held in County Clare. The people voted him in, and he was elected an MP, a member of Parliament. He argued that since he was duly elected, he should take his seat in Parliament. His support was so vast, the British realized they would have to change the law. So in 1829, the British Parliament passed the Catholic Emancipation Act. Finally, Catholics could sit in Parliament and hold important jobs. Later, O'Connell took on a new quest to argue that Ireland should have its own Parliament. The Irish rallied to his support. The British did not approve and threw O'Connell in prison for a time. Fighting broke out and the Irish threatened to use violence, but O'Connell insisted on nonviolent and peaceful demonstrations. In the end, the British did not back down and little headway was gained. Although he never succeeded with the Irish self-rule, Daniel O'Connell goes down in history as a charismatic leader who helped liberate the island's Catholics. Now, let's look at the monument. This marble and bronze monstrosity was unveiled on August 15, 1882. The monument was designed and sculpted by John Henry Foley and his assistant Thomas Brock. Standing on the monument, O'Connell is oriented pointing west across the river toward the Parliament building, symbolizing his persistent insistence over the Act of Union. At his feet are a pile of books thought to symbolize his education and eloquent arguments before the Parliament. Just before O'Connell is the Maid of Erin, pointing at O'Connell with one hand, holding the Act of Emancipation with her other. Laying at her feet are the broken shackles representing her break from bondage. Below is a frieze with more than 30 people representing the Catholic Church, professionals, trades, the arts, and peasantry. And at the base, notice the four winged women representing the virtues of patriotism, courage, eloquence, and fidelity. Finally, notice the pockmarked bullet holes from the 1916 Rising and the 1922-23 Civil War. Look for them up on the angels, on wings, an arm, or the chest of one, and on the man himself. Okay, turn around and walk across the O'Connell Bridge. When the road divides, take the right fork, that's Westmoreland Street. Hug the right side of the road. Soon you'll come to Fleet Street on your right. Turn right onto Fleet Street. Fleet Street defines the neighborhood in which you are now standing. Now it's known as Dublin's best district for popular bars, pubs, traditional music, trendy nightclubs, and an artist's mecca. But it has not always been such. In the Middle Ages, this area along the banks of the Liffey was St. Andrew's Parish, a suburb outside the city walls. In the 14th century, it was abandoned due to constant attacks from the native Irish via the River Liffey. In the 17th century, when Dublin was thriving as a second city of Britain, wealthy English families settled here. They built Georgian mansions with fancy backyard gardens flowing down to the banks of the Liffey. The Liffey at that time had no retaining walls, just a muddy sandbar changing with each day's tide. Soon you'll come to the Hard Rock Cafe on the right. Skip it. You don't need to stop here. Then another block on the left, find the yellow multi-story building, Oliver St. John Gogarty. This is an iconic pub in the Temple Bar District, and although Oliver St. John Gogarty has nothing to do with this building or pub, he was quite a character and worthy of being remembered here. You see, Oliver St. John Gogarty was born in Rutland Square in Dublin in 1878. By the way, you visited Rutland Square on this walk, now known as Parnell Square and the Garden of Remembrance. Oliver St. John Gogarty was a poet, an author, a physician, politician, and an activist. If you stumble through the reading of the first chapter of James Joyce's Ulysses, he was the inspiration of Joyce's character Buck Mulligan. Continue walking on Fleet Street and wander while I tell you a little more about Temple Bar. The banks of the Liffey reached this street in the early 17th century. When mansions began to pop up here, this was the front yard. The marshy area between here and the Liffey on your right were filled in and transformed into backyard gardens. Sir William Temple owned one of these mansions in the early 1600s, and it is thought that the name Temple's Bar originated here. William Temple was the provost of Trinity College from 1609 until his death in 1627. However, William Temple living here may have contributed to its name, but another more famous Temple Bar in London on the bank of the Thames is probably the primary origin of Dublin's Temple Bar name. In the 18th century, there was a decline of those mansions along the riverbank, and Temple Bar became Dublin's red light district. In succeeding centuries, it slowly declined, and by the turn of the 20th century, it was a neglected area suffering from urban decay and derelict buildings. When the 1970s rolled around, Temple Bar was blighted, littered with crumbled buildings, and loaded with vagrants, druggies, and trash. The state-owned bus company, CIE, proposed to demolish the entire district and build a modern bus depot. CIE purchased the old crumbling buildings, but there was a lot of red tape to navigate with the Zoning and Planning Commission. It took years, and in the meantime, the old buildings were let out to low-rent tenants. Back in the 1980s, this attracted small mom-and-pop shops, artists, galleries, and entertainers. Meanwhile, plans proceeded to demolish the district, put in underground parking, a multi-story shopping center, and the bus station on the third level. Long ramps would be built up to the third story to accommodate double-decker buses. By the 1990s, there was still no bus depot, and the former derelict Temple Bar was loaded with small businesses, pubs, and galleries. Protests abound. Finally, Ireland's leader, the Taoiseach, stepped in and secured funding for a government not-for-profit company called Temple Bar Properties to oversee the gentrification and preservation of what became modern-day Temple Bar, Dublin's cultural quarter. Well, by now you've probably walked a block or so and arrived at Temple Bar Square. This is the heart of Temple Bar. Look up Crown Alley to the left, about half a block down, is Leo Burdock's Fish and Chip, what most name is Dublin's finest chippy, a takeaway fish and chip shop. Next door is my favorite pub, the Old Storehouse. Well, we've got about 10 minutes remaining on this tour, but maybe you'll come back here later for a bit of food and a pint. Continue walking on Temple Bar Street, the Liffey to your right. At the end of the square, turn on Found Street Lower, walk a block to Cecilia Street, and make a right. Along the way, notice a discreet McDonald's on the right and a UK chain gourmet Burger King on the other side. Most of these buildings here in Temple Bar appear old, but really, they've only been here a couple of decades. The cobbles, too, they were trucked in to provide an old, historic feel to the area. Pre-renovation, Temple Bar really looked like this, but by the 1980s and 1990s, their structural integrity had disintegrated, making most of the buildings uninhabitable. Notice the graffiti and artsy ambiance along the way. Ethnic restaurants, record shops, and empty buildings line this street. The place comes alive at night when people are partying and hurling into the wee hours of the morning. Look left down Crown Street. About halfway on the right is F.X. Buckley's, a meat cutter's butcher shop institution in Dublin. The original is up on Moore Street, up by the GPO. This once butcher shop is now a restaurant and my favorite steak and chop shop in the area. If you want to eat here later, be sure to pop in or call to make a reservation. They only have a few tables. Now, look up in front of you. The red building in the distance with pictures and murals is the Wall of Fame, a museum honoring musicians with ties to Ireland. Walk up closer for a look. You can see some of the murals as a picture of U2, the Cranberries, Sinead O'Connor, Van Morrison, Phil Lynott, and more. This wall is part of the Irish Rock and Roll Museum, and if you're into that kind of music scene, it's worth an hour to have a look around. Speaking of music, let's not forget about traditional Irish music, or trad as they call it. Clodagh Records, just up the street, has a treasure trove of records, CDs, and recordings. Plus, there's usually a knowledgeable staff member there to get you into the trad scene. Okay, let's finish this portion of the walk. turn right at the Irish Rock and Roll Museum, and walk on up to Temple Lane South, back to Essex Street and Temple Bar Square. Well, this ends the part of the tour for now. There's a bit more to see in Dublin, but I think you might want a pint and something to eat. You'll not find any bad choices here. All the pubs and restaurants serve good food and good drink. We'll catch up later for part two of this walk, but for now, enjoy the ambience. Sláinte. Continue walking in the same direction on Essex Street West. You are in the heart of Temple Bar here. The Temple Bar pub, all decked out with a shiny red paint job and white Christmas lights, is often confused with the name of this area. The Temple Bar pub was licensed in 1840 as a public house. Although ownership has changed, as has the building and location, this building is the most famous Temple Bar. In 1992, the Clary family purchased this building and have cleaned up the area, spruced up the building, and been serving good food, great beer, and traditional music ever since. You've got a bit of a walk to do down Essex Street West. The street winds and jogs a bit, but keep on it. Soon, you'll cross Parliament Street. Hey, be sure to watch out for the automobile traffic here. Across the street, Essex Street West becomes a small walking lane. Continue one more block to Fishamble Street and turn left. Ahead, you'll see the white modern facade of Dublin's City Council building. There was quite an uproar here in the 1970s when the Dublin City Council decided to build here. This was the site of Dublin, the original Viking settlement dating back to 800. The Scandinavian warriors arrived here on longboats in 795 and ruled with an iron fist for almost three centuries before being defeated at Clontarf. If you have time, take a detour to the river. Walk around the city council grounds, known as Wood Quay, find the old city walls, and look for several plaques and artifacts that were discovered during the excavation process of this building. Fishamble Street is famous. The noted composer, George Frederick Handel, lived here in Dublin for a time in the mid-18th century. He premiered The Messiah right here on Fishamble Street. It burst on the stage of the Music Hall here in Dublin on April 13, 1742. The audience swelled to a record 700 people as ladies had to heed pleas by the management not to wear dresses with hoops in them in order to make room for more company. The Music Hall is in the building marked Keenan and Sons, LTD. Across the street is Christ Church Cathedral. The original cathedral was founded in the 11th century by Sitrick Silkenbeard, the Viking king. Made mostly of wood, it only lasted about 150 years. In the late 12th century, the cathedral was completely rebuilt of stone under the leadership of the Norman leader Strongbow. It saw further remodels and improvements through the centuries, and what you see here today dates from the late 19th century. The tower, flying buttress, and stone-covered footbridge all date from that last renovation. Interestingly, Christchurch is officially claimed as the cathedral of both the Anglican Church of Ireland and the Roman Catholic Archbishops of Dublin. Keep it in mind, there was only one Christian church until the English Reformation in the 16th century. Nowadays, the Roman Catholic Archbishop of Dublin uses St. Mary's Church up in Marlborough Street as his acting cathedral. From the entrance door of Christchurch, walk on the street, heading south toward Dublin's other cathedral. You'll arrive there after about three blocks on your left. St. Patrick's Cathedral. The first church is reported being built here on the site where Patrick baptized pagan converts to Christianity. The building you see today dates from the 13th century with many renovations, rebuilds, and improvements over time. After the Reformation, St. Patrick's passed on to the Anglican Church. Then, when Oliver Cromwell and his Puritan Calvinist troops invaded Ireland in 1649 to 1653, the church became stables for their horses. Jonathan Swift of Gulliver's Travel fame was the cathedral dean for 32 years, beginning in 1713. He's buried near the front door on the right side of the nave. From the outside, notice how far the front door and foundation are below the current street level. This is an indication of how much the city has been built up in just the last 300 years. Leave St. Patrick's, head to the right, to the north, back toward Christchurch. Feel free to wander in the adjacent St. Patrick's Gardens for a peaceful stroll and a good photo opportunity. At Christchurch, turn right onto Dame Street. Curve left and then right. Walk two more blocks until you come to the Dublin Castle. Dublin Castle. This castle was the seat of British rule for over 700 years. It sprawls over several acres in many different architectural styles. Originally, the River Liffey and the River Poddle came together here, making a black pool, or in Irish, Dublin, hence the name of the city. Dublin Castle was the official residence of the British Viceroy. By the way, Viceroy is a blend of the Latin word vice and the French word roi for king, so vice king, or the monarch's representative here in Dublin. Visiting the interior and the state apartments is nice, but there are much better castles in Europe if you're going to pay for a tour. I suggest walking through the courtyard, turning left, passing the old medieval tower, and exiting left back toward Dame Street through the stone gates. City Hall sits where you entered the castle gates. The Dublin City Hall now occupies what was the first Georgian building built in this city. It was the former Royal Exchange and was built in 1779. It has been the City Hall since 1852. Take a moment to pop inside. It's free to get in there. And notice the 18-foot statue of Daniel O'Connell. Downstairs, there is an exhibit. It's called The Story of the Capitol, which tells the history of Dublin City via placards and a film. Exit right, walk along Dame Street, about a half mile. Notice the big white multi-storied building across the street on the left. I've often thought this is one of the ugliest buildings in all of the city, and coming here 20 years ago for the first time, I really didn't think it fit the decor of Trinity Bar. Now I have a better appreciation for this building. This is Central Plaza, and from 1979 to 2017, the Central Bank of Ireland was its major tenant. Some say it's ugly and out of place here amongst Trinity Bar and the adjacent Georgian architecture. But look closer. The floors of the building are not touching one another. They are hanging from a central structural core. This is a one-of-a-kind structure. It is likely under renovation for the next few years, but when complete, it will be a mighty work of art connecting Dublin's north and south with shops, restaurants, offices, cafes, and a glass-enclosed rooftop venue unlike any other. Keep walking along the opposite side of Dame Street from Central Plaza. Just beyond, turn right onto Trinity Street and walk to the end. Turn left on St. Andrew Street. The old St. Andrew's Church now stands deconsecrated and derelict, but in front there's a very important bronze statue, Molly Malone, a Dublin legend. Molly Malone was a local legend, and her story was captured in song in the 1800s. The first verse goes a bit like this. In Dublin's fair city, where the girls are all pretty, I first set my eyes on sweet Molly Malone. She wheeled her wheelbarrow through streets wide and narrow, singing cockles and mussels, alive, alive, oh. Alive, alive, oh. Alive, alive, oh. Singing cockles and mussels, alive, alive, oh. Well, there you have it. The first verse of Molly Malone. From Molly, turn around and notice the pretty O'Neill's pub and kitchen with its seemingly always blooming flower pots. Walk to the left of O'Neill's down Church Lane, return to Dame Street. Across the street is the Parliament Building. This building is the former home of the Irish Parliament. It was built in 1792 and remodeled to what you see today in 1796. It is now the Bank of Ireland, so getting inside is often a chore with security and locked doors. Recently, they have taken to placing a sign at the door warning tourists that the House of Lords is closed, but if you can get in, it's worth a look around. The entrance, looking at the building from the front, is through the black wrought iron fence along the portico on the right. The Irish had been oppressed and occupied in one form or the other since 1168, when Henry II claimed the island his own. There has been plenty of Irish rebellions over the years, but none has succeeded in independence. By the late 16th century, there was some hope of independence, fostered by politicians like Henry Grattan. That's him out there in the middle of the College Green Street with his right hand raised to the sky. Grattan and others pushed for parliamentary reforms, and by 1782, Ireland's legislative independence was restored. But that was short-lived. It was here in 1800 that the Act of Union was signed into law, and Ireland was granted nation status. But the downside was the Irish Parliament had to move to London and join Parliament there. The Irish Parliament building was left empty and eventually sold to the Bank of Ireland. Across the street is the west front of Trinity College. Imagine this busy intersection you see here being, in the late 1790s, a peaceful and grand college green dominated by Parliament House on the north and Trinity College on the east. A wide, tree-lined pedestrian boulevard stretched to the west for a mile down to Dublin Castle. Let's look at Trinity College. Cross College Green Street and walk through the black wrought iron fence into the main entrance of Trinity College. Trinity College was founded in 1592 by Queen Elizabeth I to bring civility to the Irish and impress the Tudor ideals of Protestant religion and learning. At the time, Dublin was a rich and gleaming city, second only to London in culture, education, and Protestant beliefs. Beyond the Pale of Dublin, that's about a 50-mile radius, the rest of Ireland was dirty, poor, and uneducated Catholics. Enter the arched doorway and have a look around at the gatehouse. Notice the floor made from expertly carved hexagonal pieces of wood. Also, check out the notice boards dotted with student notices such as rooms for rent and posters for coming events. Continue through and exit the opposite door. You are in Parliament Square, a symmetrical rectangle framed by Georgian buildings. The English-Georgian period parallels the reign of the English Hanover kings George I, II, III, and IV. That's roughly 1714 to 1830. This was the era of Baroque music, symmetry, balance, and order. The Greeks and Romans first introduced this style. Columns supporting triangular pediments, all equally planned and mathematically correct. In the United States and other parts of the world, this style is known as neoclassical. Think of all the monuments and buildings in Washington, D.C., and you've got the idea. In front of you is the most recognized icon of Trinity College. The Campanile, or bell tower, is 100 feet tall and was built in 1853. It, too, is in the Georgian architectural style, with columns, domes, bases, all in symmetry and in harmony. Notice the keystone pillars of the four arches at the base. The carved heads are those of Socrates, Plato, Homer, and Demosthenes. They all represent the liberal arts. Higher up, the four classical figures are those of divinity with the cross, science with the staff, medicine with the prescription tablet, and law with the fasces. Now, I didn't know what a fasces was. That is an ancient Etruscan symbol passed down to the Romans. It's often a bundle of sticks, sometimes with an axe protruding from the bundle, and it represents a magistrate's power and jurisdiction. Flanking Parliament Square are two buildings with Georgian features. The one on the left is a chapel, and the one on the right is the theater and examination hall. Behind the Campanile are a few red brick buildings. They're the oldest on campus, built here in 1712. Now, to the right of the Campanile is the old library. It houses a lot of books, an old Irish harp, and the Book of Kells, an ancient illuminated manuscript of the four Gospels. We'll not go in today, but if you get a chance, purchase a ticket online and come back later to see this fantastic illuminated Book of Kells. Take the sidewalk running between the theater and the old library. Soon you'll come over to another grassy green mall area known as Fellows Square. The Book of Kells entrance is over to the left. Walk down the sidewalk past the people standing in line. Continue straight to the building in front of you, the Berklee College Library. To the left of the library is a paved area or forecourt of the library. Here, find a polished bronze sphere. This sphere is known as Sfera con Sfera. That's Italian for sphere within a sphere. It was produced and donated by the artist Arnaldo Pomodoro in 1992. Pomodoro has produced and displayed similar spheres at the United Nations Plaza in New York, the University of California at Berkeley, the Museum of Contemporary Art in Tehran, and the Ministry of Foreign Affairs in Rome. And finally, at the Cortile del Belvedere at the Vatican Museums in Rome, or Vatican City. Retrace your route and exit Trinity College. Turn left, follow the stone Trinity College fence to the next intersection, cross the street toward the Blue Boyle Sport Bookmaker, look up and find the engraved stone placard, Irish Permanent. You're at the top of Grafton Street. Grafton Street, along with Henry Street on the other side of the river, are Dublin's liveliest pedestrian streets. Grafton Street links Trinity College with Stephen's Green, about a 10-minute walk from here. But you'll want to linger a little longer, and we'll take a short detour as well. On Grafton Street, you'll find two department stores, the all-Irish Brown Thomas and the English Marks & Spencer. Also, check out Bewley's Oriental Cafe and Coffee. It's about halfway down Grafton Street on the right. Bewley's first opened in 1927, and Bewley's Cafe is renowned for the high quality of its food, coffee, and tea, as well as its priceless Harry Clark stained glass windows, art, and sculpture. The centerpiece of the cafe remains to this day the six magnificent stained glass windows commissioned from the renowned artist Harry Clark, who completed them just prior to his death in 1931. Coffee beans are still roasted here on site, guaranteeing a fresh cup of coffee. Additionally, Bewley's has a full license and sells very good wines by the glass, as well as cocktail, beer, and ales. At Johnson's Court, a short lane to the right, it leads to Powerscourt Townhouse Shopping Center, a remodeled Georgian mansion with lots of ambience and shops. At the end, near Stephen's Green, is another shopping center known as Stephen's Green Shopping Center, with a turn-of-the-century Art Nouveau charm. Lining Grafton Street, you'll find buskers and street entertainers who make a decent living performing for the crowds. About halfway down Grafton Street, take a detour to the left on Ann Street South. In front of you is St. Anne's Church, known for its beautiful stained glass and hosted concerts. At the church, turn right onto Dawson Street. The white house you see there is Mansion House. Mansion House has been the official residence of the Lord Mayor of Dublin since 1715. It was built in 1710 by the merchant and developer Joshua Dawson, after whom Dawson Street is named. Now, either turn around and walk back to Grafton Street, or continue on Dawson Street to Stephen's Green. Either way, enter Stephen's Green through the marble arch at the foot of Grafton Street. You got a plan, it's hard. I got a plan to get us out of here, been working out. St. Stephen's Green. Enter the park through the white marble arch near Grafton Street. Turn left and follow the banks of the lake while I tell you a bit about this 22-acre lush refuge in the heart of Dublin's bustling city. As you've learned on this walk through Dublin, Dublin is really a big city. 1.4 million people live in the Dublin metro area. That's a little more than one quarter of Ireland's total population. By the way, the population of Ireland is just over 5 million. Now, couple that with Northern Ireland's almost 2 million, and that adds up to about 7 million living on this island. Follow the lake's edge, curving to the right, cross the bridge, and enter the grassy formal gardens at the center of the park. When these gardens were conceived in 1663, there was little here but a marshy area used for grazing animals. The Dublin Corporation bought the area and sold 96 plots of land around the perimeter, leaving this park as a private space for the tenants. By the middle of the 18th century, most of the original homes were demolished to make room for new buildings built in the Georgian style. So when you exit, take a look at the 96 buildings surrounding Stephen's Green, noting the symmetrical red brick exterior with various colored doors and lintels. The park remained private, just like the nearby Marion Square and Fitzwilliam Squares, for 100 years. But in July 1880, it was officially opened to the public and has been a place of solitude and refuge ever since. On sunny days, you'll find office workers enjoying a bit of free time and perhaps eating their lunches. You'll see school kids playing, floating boats in the lake, or jumping around on the playground equipment. At the center of the green is a beautiful park, manicured and planted with whatever flower blooms at the time. Why not find a bench, have a seat, and let's wrap up this Dublin walking tour. In 1916, Stephen's Green was one of the battleground areas, just like the GPO. During that Easter Monday clash, young rebels dug trenches here, World War I style, to make a stand against the British troops. There were not as many trees here then, and entrenched rebels were sitting ducks for the British troops, who positioned themselves on the rooftop of the nearby Gresham Hotel and mowed down the rebels. When you exit the park, turn around and take a look at that marble arch. Over on the left-hand side, find bullet scars and pock marks from that tragic day in 1916. Well, in the last few hours, we've covered Dublin from the Garden of Remembrance to O'Connell Street, the Liffey, Temple Bar, two cathedrals, a castle, Parliament House, Trinity College, Grafton Street, and more. I hope you've learned a bit about the Irish and the history of Dublin and what makes the Irish who they are today. Soon, you may be leaving Dublin and heading out into the countryside. With this walk, you've already experienced a bit of what's in store out beyond the pale. Enjoy the 40 shades of green here in Stephen's Green. There's a lot more out there and the rest of Ireland. Hey, your adventure starts right here with David McGuffin's Exploring Europe. Thanks for participating in this Dublin walking tour with me.